Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the arrest and indictment of the dirty trickster and close advisor to Donald Trump, Roger Stone, and speak with someone who knows him well, Sidney Blumenthal, the former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, and author of the bestsellers The Clinton Wars, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, and The Permanent Campaign. He joins us to discuss how, when the mob lawyer Roy Cohn, who represented Trump, was dying of AIDS, he handed off Roger Stone to Trump to be his replacement, and that Stone was instrumental in writing the full-page ad denouncing NATO Trump placed in the New York Times in 1987, just after Trump's return from the Soviet Union. We'll look into how Stone recommended Paul Manafort to Trump to be his 2016 campaign manager, and how the two spoke often on the phone throughout the campaign, making it likely that among the seven counts special counsel Mueller brought against Stone on Friday for witness tampering and making false statements to Congress, Stone's conversation with Trump are sure to be the focus of further investigation into a possible link between Trump, the Trump campaign, and the cyber attack on the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton. Then we'll follow up on what legal jeopardy Trump may be facing if Roger Stone agrees to cooperate with the Mueller investigation, and speak with James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his stories in The Times in 2007 about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. His latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And he joins us to discuss his article at The Intercept, Roger Stone Made His Name as a Dirty Trickster, but the Trump-Russia cover-up may finally bring him down. Then finally, we'll examine the deepening isolation of the Maduro government in Venezuela, with the United States and 20 mostly South American nations recognizing the president of Venezuela's National Assembly, Juan Guaido, as the head of state, as European governments threaten to recognize him too unless a plan for new elections is announced in the next 8 days. Alejandro Velasco, a professor at New York University and a historian of Latin America, who is the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics in the Making of Modern Venezuela, joins us to discuss how economic incentives will help Guaido, while military threats from the United States will help Maduro cling to power. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors, so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Sidney Blumenthal, a former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. He's been a national staff reporter for The Washington Post, Washington editor and staff writer for The New Yorker, and his books include the bestsellers The Clinton Wars, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, and The Permanent Campaign. And his latest book is Wrestling with His Angel, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 2, 1849 to 1856, and Volume 3 of the trilogy on Abraham Lincoln will be out in September. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sidney Blumenthal.
Glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Sidney. And you know Roger Stone, who seems to be relishing the publicity, even though his fate may be not so rosy. And I guess he was an antagonist in terms of the Clinton Wars. Tell us about his role in this sort of shadow world of opposition research, political dirty tricks.
Well, I knew Roger since the 1984 Reagan campaign, when he was working for Reagan. Of course, he had begun his career as a dirty trickster in Watergate when he was a mere stripling, doing all sorts of dirty tricks against Democrats, and had been questioned by the Watergate Committee. That was his formative experience. Roger, it should be underlined, made possible the political career of Donald Trump. Donald Trump, as a political figure, would not have happened without Roger Stone. Roger Stone is instrumental for Donald Trump. When I was a reporter for the Washington Post, Roger Stone explain to me how he gained control of Donald Trump. It's an interesting story. I was with Roger in New York in late 1987. I was a reporter for the Washington Post. I was covering an event in which Donald Trump, then the owner of the Plaza Hotel, was holding a fundraiser there for George H.W. Bush at the beginning of his presidential campaign. And the gaudy Trump was leading the WASP Bush, you know, through ice sculptures that Trump had created. Stone and I went out to dinner afterwards, and he told me how Roy Cohn had handed off Trump to him as a client. Roy Cohn, of course, was the counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy, and in many ways his puppet master, and had then become the center of evil in New York, the lawyer for the mafia crime families, as well as the Archdiocese, Catholic Archdiocese of New York and the New York Yankees, and Donald Trump. Cohn was dying of AIDS. He shows up at 21, which is the famous old restaurant there, tells Stone to meet him. They sit in the red leather banquettes, famous banquettes, and Cohn can't walk. He's brought in to the restaurant by two burly guys. He can't walk. He's deposited in the booth. Never felt better, he tells Roger Stone. He's dying. He says to Stone, I want you to make an appointment to have lunch with Donald Trump in 2 months. Stone does it. During that period, Roy Cohn dies of AIDS. Stone shows up. Trump says to Stone, Roy said you'd show up, you'd be here. And it was the beginning of their relationship, with Roger Stone assuming the place of Roy Cohn as the handler of Donald Trump, and the beginning of their political relationship that has now ended, at least to this point, with Roger Stone's arrest.
So Roger Stone, I mean, I don't think that Donald Trump has any friends. He certainly doesn't have a dog. So what about the often mentioned description of them as friends? Does Trump have friends? And if so, would Roger Stone be one of his closest?
To my knowledge, Donald Trump has no real friends. He has people who work for him. I do know that Roger holds him in contempt and privately refers to him as a, you know, child who needs to be handled and manipulated. Roger completely manipulates Trump to the extent that he can, and regards him as a property. Just as Trump regards Roger as somebody to use for his own purposes. They're exploiting each other. There is no true friendship here. And Stone, from the beginning of the handoff from Roy Cohn, began handling Trump. What we don't understand, and what is not in the long stories now that have been published since Roger's arrest, is that Roger began running Trump for president in 1987. He brought him to New Hampshire. It was a test run. Things went okay, but he didn't run. He was going to run as a Republican. And what we don't remember is that in 1987, in July, Donald Trump went to Moscow to try and get the funding for the Moscow Trump Tower. It was his first effort at that. And when he returned in September, he ran a full-page ad denouncing NATO, denouncing the Western Alliance, which was, of course, part of his bid to get Russian money to build this. And the person who helped place that ad and helped him write it was Roger Stone, who then brought him to New Hampshire to run as a presidential candidate. So Trump's presidential ambitions began very early and at the hands of Roger Stone.
And if there was no affection there, we learned that Roger Stone has a tattoo of Richard Nixon between his shoulder blades. Is there a likelihood that he'll ever have a tattoo of Donald Trump on his back as well?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be on his back. Roger worships Richard Nixon. Roger Stone introduced me to Richard Nixon when in 1984 and brought me to his house with a small group of reporters when Nixon was attempting his reintroduction into public life after his Watergate disgrace. I was brought to his house at Saddle River, New Jersey by Roger. I found it comical that the Nixon Foundation issued a declaration, a statement that Roger Stone had no real relationship with Richard Nixon. That was completely false, and I witnessed it firsthand because Roger introduced me to Richard Nixon. What's interesting also about Trump and his personal relations with people is that even though, and he says today, you know, where's my Roy Cohn? He wants a lawyer to act as his intimidator to end all the investigations of him, which is the function that Roy Cohn served for him in part, as well as providing mafia help in the building of Trump Tower and other projects. But when Cohn was dying of AIDS, Trump abandoned him. And Cohn said, Trump pisses ice water. So Trump has no loyalty to anybody. He has no true friendships. And his relationships are all transactional and selfish.
And again, I'm speaking with Sidney Blumenthal, who's the former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and a senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. He's been a national staff reporter for the Washington Post, Washington editor and staff writer for the New Yorker, and his books include the best-selling The Clinton Wars, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment and the Permanent Campaign. And his latest book is Wrestling with His Angel, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 2, 1849 to 1956. And Volume 3 of the trilogy on Abraham Lincoln will be out in September. Well, when you mentioned, Sidney Blumenthal, the 1987 trip to Russia by Donald Trump, whose wife Ivana was acting as his translator, and he went there ostensibly on the invitation of Ambassador Dubinin, but I have some information that indeed he was essentially recruited by the KGB at that point. At least they tried to recruit him, or they wanted somebody to replace Armand Hammer as what they call a trusted contact. And the fact that he immediately thereafter, they took out the full-page ad, and as you mentioned, Roger Stone wrote that ad, and it, ironically enough, of course, it talked about getting out of NATO, which is exactly what people are afraid that Donald Trump is about to do. He was within a couple of minutes of going to the microphones and answering it when he was intercepted by General Mattis, who's no longer there. So talk about a full circle.
Well, it began early. The Trump relationship with Russia is long, and there's a lot more to be learned about it.
Sure.
Stone, there's another point to be mentioned about Stone. Stone has never gone away. He goes in and out, but he always comes back. Trump is, even though there has no real friends, is also been dependent on Stone, and he has this relationship, and Stone is in his head. And he, throughout the 2016 campaign, went back to Stone again and again. Stone was among those who were crucial in recommending Paul Manafort, Roger Stone's former partner, to Donald Trump to be his campaign manager. And Stone and Trump had long conversations on the phone that were not monitored by anybody in the campaign. Whether Stone will recollect those for the special counsel, Robert Mueller, now, if he wants to cooperate, we will see. But he knows a lot about what Trump said, and we don't know what Trump instructed him to do in relation to contacting WikiLeaks or Russian sources about the stolen Democratic National Committee and Clinton campaign manager John Podesta's personal emails. But certainly Stone was seeking those. He was directed to do so by the campaign, as we know from the indictment. We know that Stephen Bannon, a senior Trump campaign official, who is not named but is acknowledged to reporters, that he is one of those sources who had a relationship with Stone and was knowledgeable and encouraging and directing him about this. And in the indictment, after the Podesta emails are hacked, tells Stone, "Well done." That's a quote in the indictment. So if you want to talk about collusion, there's certainly intent here. There's as much collusion as needs to be established, but there's more to be learned. And Mueller in the indictment has laid out certain pieces. Undoubtedly, he knows more. Stone was among those involved, so almost certainly not the only person. And Trump knew a great deal. And Trump was in constant contact on the phone, personally and directly, with Donald Trump. And it beggars the imagination that they did not discuss this matter of the Russian hacking of the Clinton emails.
Well, just in closing, Sidney Blumenthal, given that Roger Stone was involved in writing the full-page ad after Trump's 1987 visit to Russia calling for the U.S. to get out of NATO, and then you mentioned him recommending Manafort to become Trump's campaign manager. Manafort's, of course, ties to the Russians through his deputy in Ukraine, Konstantin Kalimnik, a GRU officer, are pretty manifest, and we'll learn, obviously, a lot more, as we will, about what Stone had to do with the WikiLeaks data dump in collusion with Julian Assange. So all of that is poised to happen, but the question arises, is he driven by ideology or what? Because, in 1987, that was Reagan was president, the Cold War was on. Why would you be playing footsie with the Soviets?
It's an interesting question. In the indictment, Roger Stone's emails engaged in witness tampering cites Godfather II, the movie, and the figure of Frank Pantangeli, who is a mafia figure who was going to squeal and be a rat against the Corleone family, and then appears at a Senate hearing and says he doesn't know anything, and then finally commits suicide in order to protect his family. But there's another movie that's relevant here, and that movie is The Manchurian Candidate. Roy Cohn was the inspiration for that movie, according to the author of the book, The Manchurian Candidate, Richard Condon. And it's a story about how the Russians try and install a presidential candidate as president in the United States. And Cohn, of course, was the great Red Hunter, the great anti-communist, the man behind Joseph McCarthy, the one who forced the electrocution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, the Soviet atomic spies. And then he hands off Trump to Roger Stone. And within a year of Cohn's death, Roger Stone is putting out full-page ads denouncing NATO from somebody who is behind the scenes trying to take Russian money. And possibly more. So there's another movie to be made here.
Well, we are speaking to you from across the street from Universal Studios, Sydney, here in North Hollywood. So I'm sure some of our listeners are screenwriters. So stay tuned for the movie that you just talked about. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Sidney Blumenthal, the former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and a senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. He's been a national staff reporter for The Washington Post, Washington editor and staff writer for The New Yorker, and his books include the best-selling The Clinton Wars, The Rise of the Counter-Establishment, and The Permanent Campaign. And his latest book is Wrestling with His Angel, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 2, 1849 to 1856, and Volume 3 of Sidney Blumenthal's trilogy on Abraham Lincoln will be out in September. Going to take a B-station break and we'll be back following up on what legal jeopardy Trump may be facing if Roger Stone agrees to cooperate with the Mueller investigation.
Real friends, how many of us, how many of us, how many jealous? Real friends, it's not many of us, we smile at each other. But how many honest trust issues? Switch up the number. I can't be bothered. I cannot blame you for having an angle. I ain't got no issues. I'm just doing my thing. Hope you're doing your thing too. I'm a deadbeat cousin. I hate family.
Ain't no sound but the sound of speech. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Another one bites the dust. And another one gone. And another one gone. Another one bites the dust. Hey, hey, we're gonna get you too.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and author of The New York Times bestseller State of War, among other books. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA, and in 2007, he was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War, and he has an article at The Intercept. Roger Stone made his name as a dirty trickster, but the Trump-Russia cover-up may finally bring him down. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Risen.
Thanks for having me.
So, James, in your article, you talk about how Stone has been sort of defiant. He's taunted the Mueller investigation. He's behaved in public like a clown. Reveling in his cheap celebrity, which he did, of course, when he raised his arms Nixon-style with a victory salute as he came out of the federal court in Florida, where he was indicted on seven counts, witness tampering and lying to Congress. He's in trouble, is he not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think the fact that the FBI raided his house at dawn to arrest him and then probably searched his house was a sign that Mueller was tired of his antics. And, you know, he didn't let him surrender like other white-collar criminals usually get away with. Surrender with his lawyer and make an appearance. He had the full raid, the full FBI experience.
With CNN tagging along to show the rest of the world, right?
Right. So I think, I don't think Stone can expect any plea deals from Mueller. I think he'll get prosecuted as hard as Mueller can do it.
So will Stone flip then under that pressure? Our previous guest, by the way, you didn't hear this, James, Sidney Blumenthal said that, and he's known Stone a long time, and Stone has told him many times how much he doesn't like Trump. Nobody that works for Trump particularly likes him, that he's a child,
right,
and you have to handle him and manipulate him, etc. So there doesn't sound like there's a lot of loyalty there, not that there's any loyalty coming from Trump.
No, I think all these people around Trump, it's all very transactional. But you look at the case of Paul Manafort, who has still not cooperated fully with Mueller, even though he kind of tried to cut a plea deal, and which has gotten him into even more legal jeopardy with the new charges that Mueller has brought against him. I think, you know, this is pure speculation, but I think some of these people around him still expect some kind of pardon out of Trump, which may or may not ever come. I mean, because Trump feels no loyalty to anybody.
Well, are you saying that they're stupid holding out for a pardon then, James?
Yeah, I think they are. Because especially in Manafort's case, where his refusal to cooperate fully, as he said he would, has brought new charges against him. Mm. So I don't think he's, unless, you know, Trump sees it in his own interest to pardon these people, which is possible, I don't think he ever will. I mean, I don't think he won't lift a finger to help anybody unless he knows for a fact that it's in his own interest.
Well, it looks like from the indictments that Mueller is focusing in on Stone's role with the WikiLeaks data dump after the Russian GRU had hacked the DNC and Podesta's emails, which obviously happened later. The coincidences there are pretty extraordinary, dumping all this damaging stuff to Hillary Clinton ahead of the Democratic National Convention, and then when the damaging videotape from Access Hollywood comes out about Trump boasting about being a celebrity and being able to grab women's private parts with impunity because he's a celebrity, the very next day another WikiLeaks data dump comes out to take the curse off that story that had Trump on the ropes. So talk about collusion. It's pretty clear, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think the one of the most telling things in the Stone indictment is, from the way you read it, it looks like Stone in June or July, maybe several times, of 2016 went to the Trump campaign. And, you know, he had been on the Trump campaign in 2015, but was no longer officially on it, but he was obviously close. He goes to them and says, you know, WikiLeaks has, you know, is going to release this stuff. And this is after the DNC has already said we've been hacked by the Russians. And he goes to the Trump campaign and says, we're going to, WikiLeaks is going to release this stuff. And it's only after, I think the most telling thing is, it's only after the July 22nd first release by WikiLeaks of some some Democratic documents that they evidently at the Trump campaign take Stone seriously. And they say, oh, wait a second, he told us this was going to happen and it happened. And then they direct Stone, somebody, a senior Trump official, is told by somebody higher up who is unnamed, you better get with Stone and figure out what WikiLeaks is doing. Because it's obvious what happened is Stone got information. He passes it on to the Trump people. They don't necessarily take him seriously or do anything with it until there's a release by WikiLeaks, just like he said there was. And so then they say, oh, okay, let's take Roger seriously and let's figure out what we can do. That's the heart of the matter in the Stone indictment. And it gets as close to conspiracy, collusion, whatever you want to call it, as we've seen so far.
Well, in the indictments, it talks about passing off, being an intermediary between WikiLeaks' Julian Assange and someone, the head of Organization One. And then it also...
Yeah, the head of Organization One is Assange.
Right, yeah. So, and then further down, of course, the indictment says that on September the 18th, 2016, Stone sent an email to Person 2, which apparently is this character, Randy Credico. And then you've got I recently watched on MSNBC all of these characters on Ari Melba's program, Jerome Corsi and Randy and Sam Nunberg and Carter Page. Talk about a pathetic rogue galleries of losers and bottom feeders. I mean, what does that say? I guess that's what Trump brings to the surface, right?
Well, it's, you know, the thing about Stone is that he's been hiding in plain sight for, what, a year and a half about all this? And I think that is what has angered Mueller, is, you know, it's this weird thing with Stone where he says, yeah, I talked to these people, what of it? And but he was still, according to the indictment, still lying about certain aspects of it and trying to tamper with witnesses. So the whole thing just is amazing. It's an amazing story. It was always very difficult for me to take Roger Stone seriously. And I think that's what he's kind of counted on in the public, is that he's such a buffoon that nobody takes his role seriously. But obviously Mueller took it seriously.
Well, but that's a good cover, isn't it? Being a buffoon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The hide in plain sight.
Right. And again, I'm speaking with James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept, a former investigative journalist with The New York Times, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA in The New York Times. And his latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And he has an article at The Intercept, Roger Stone Made His Name as a Dirty Trickster, but the Trump-Russia cover-up may finally bring him down. So we talked a little about whether he'll flip. We know that there's no love lost between Roger Stone and Trump. And we also know that Trump – and by the way, in the earlier interview with Sidney Blumenthal, Sidney Blumenthal quoted what Roy Cohn said about Stone – about Trump, who abandoned Roy Cohn when he was dying of AIDS and took up his recommendation of having Roger Stone take over. Apparently, Roy Cohn said of Trump that he – I can't use the word – he urinates ice water. So that is who we're dealing with here. So yeah. At the end of the day, is that what it comes down to? I mentioned that Trump has no friends and he doesn't have a dog, where, of course, we learned from the indictments that Stone threatened Randy Credico that he might do something to his dog mob style. So
I still, you know, frankly, I just to step back a second, I still can't believe that Donald Trump is president. I can't believe that someone...
Well, unfortunately, it's so true, James. I mean...
Someone so unlikable, as you say, right. Someone who really has no friends, someone who went into bankruptcy, what, four times? Someone who is a liar and a racist, who has never said anything nice about anybody? It just is upside-down politics that I don't... And the only thing that makes sense to me is that this whole enterprise was about white identity and white racism, and that this was this whole Trump Russia thing was a way to collaborate with another white identity figure in Vladimir Putin. I think that's the common the common denominator here is.
Well, that's certainly that's Stephen Bannon.
There's a certain percentage of the American public that wants that supports white identity, and that's the Trump base. Mm. So we're in a situation now where we've got 35% of the country is controlling our politics
via Fox News, which is the kind of Pravda of the Trump administration. Right. That's of course a clearly something that is also where the money came from Russia. Certainly fake news came from Russia. We know that. So just in closing then, James Risen, do you think that the fact that this whole shutdown fiasco, it's embarrassing, the idea that what did he achieve? I mean, all this pain for these federal workers, and all this cheap theatrics from our reality TV president who's running out of stunts. I think, you know, his act is getting tiresome, and he's going to try and renew.
That's one of the problems. One of the problems with the Trump-Russia story is that no matter what you say, nobody, there's a certain percentage of people who will continue to support Trump. And I'm convinced that it has nothing to do with the facts anymore. It's about he will protect white identity and white supremacy. And to me, it's a lot like Iraqi politics today. It's we're down into Shia versus Sunni politics, where it doesn't matter what the politician does or says. If he's Shia, then the Shia will support him. If he's Sunni, the Sunni will support him. And I think we're down into Iraqi-level politics right now.
But what if the Mueller report makes, and assuming it's made public, what if it makes it clear that Trump is not just a criminal, which the record is manifestly clear, but is also a traitor? That constituency, aren't they the red blood of patriots, along with being, you know?
Well, the scary thing, if you look at the polls about Republicans, there's been a growing support among conservative Republicans for Russia. And over the last few years, Putin's approval ratings among hard right conservatives in the United States has gone up. It's because they see him as a guardian of white identity, just like they do Trump. And that's the scariest part of this whole story to me, is that there's a certain percentage of Republicans and conservatives who don't mind close ties between Trump and Putin.
Well, that was reflected in the Senate vote, where the Senate narrowly voted to uphold Mnuchin's outrageous, lifting the sanctions on Deripaska, Putin's buddy, the aluminum king, who personally murdered about 42 people, and is the guy that threatened Manafort, got him hooked on his money, and then put the squeeze on him. I mean, it is surreal.
Well, Manafort went from helping run a pro-Russian oligarch's campaign for president of the Ukraine, Yanukovych, and got a pro-Russian president of the Ukraine, and then he comes back and helps get Donald Trump elected. So I think the threads are pretty obvious.
Well, James Risen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and the author of the New York Times bestseller State of War. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. And in 2007, he was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And his latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And he has an article at The Intercept. Roger Stone made his name as a dirty trickster, but the Trump-Russia cover-up may finally bring him down. And we are going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the deepening isolation of Venezuela's Maduro government.
Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, 'cause you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, 'cause we be getting hyped to the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. There's a little truth. Open up your eye while you're checking out the boombox.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alejandro Velasco, who's a professor at New York University and historian of modern Latin America, focusing on social movements, urban culture, and democratization. He's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics, and the Making of Modern Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alejandro Velasco.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Alejandro. And there was some concern after Maduro broke off diplomatic relations with the United States, the U.S. decided to keep its diplomats in place, leading a lot of speculation to the possibility of hostage-taking in a crisis that could well spin out of control in this volatile situation in Venezuela. It looks as if that possibility has been diffused with Venezuela suspending a demand that U.S. diplomats leave the country. as the Trump administration, along with apparently Marco Rubio behind the scenes, are urging the world to line up against Maduro and in favor of Juan Guaido. So do you think that that is off the table now, this idea that there could be a hostage crisis?
Well, it's off the table for at least 30 days, which is what the Maduro government has said. They've extended the period of time. I mean, what they've done is to use a bit of a ruse, right, to suggest, well, we have no longer any diplomatic relations because we've technically broken them off, but we are establishing the conditions to have an office of special interests, such as they have in Cuba. But that's, you know, pretty much a fig leaf. Really, what has happened is that the Maduro government realizes that, you know, to have actually carried out the forced expulsion or something worse, as you're suggesting, perhaps just a siege of the embassy and of embassy staff would have been exactly the kind of, you know, pretext that people like Marco Rubio or Elliot Abrams, who've now been appointed as the special envoy for Venezuela by the White House, would have needed, right, to maybe escalate the situation even further. So, you know, the problem for Maduro now is that he has been left with kind of egg on his face among his internal supporters, who it remains to be seen what kind of effect this is going to have going forward.
So when the Russian ambassador in Venezuela charges that the Trump administration is trying to engineer a coup, is there a possibility that essentially what's happened here, do you think that Abrams and, well, he wasn't appointed necessarily, I think he's just been appointed, that when this thing started to unravel, but we know that Marco Rubio behind the scenes has essentially been running the Venezuela account, if you will, through the White House. He's got his people, his pick on the National Security Council. He brought in for a photo op with Donald Trump the wife of Leopoldo López, who's the imprisoned opposition leader, who was the mentor of Juan Guaido. So do you think on the American side they're looking for a provocation?
I mean, I hope not, obviously, but I think that for Rubio, as you just mentioned, for the reasons that you mentioned, that is certainly on the table. And all the signals, and I think the strongest one, again, is the appointment of Abrams, is that they are you know, they're not above taking that step if necessary. Of course, that would imply problems beyond just the immediate ones of the what that would actually look like in terms of logistical operations. It would imply, you know, significant problems also in terms of the messaging, which so far has been surprisingly coherent in terms of marshaling the support of not just other Latin American countries, but increasingly the European Union towards the position of recognizing Guaido, right? So, you know, even if there was some kind of provocation that would lead, you know, to some kind of even limited U.S. intervention, that I think would really pose a significant challenge to this larger effort to, you know, gain kind of global legitimacy towards the Guaido government. But that's not to say that they might not seek it. It's just that that it would pose an entirely different set of challenges for the U.S. government position right now.
Well, I assume that Bolton is one of the people that, and along with Rubio, have also urged the appointment of Elliot Abrams. But so, is it possible that Pompeo, is the Secretary of State, is playing a more adult role here, a less bellicose role? Who do you think's behind this strategy to bring in the EU, who are demanding essentially new elections before they join the 20 countries along with the United States that have now recognized Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in that respect, you have kind of a conventional, you know, front-facing and backward-facing you know, policy strategy happening now, where Pompeo has been the one who's been making the rounds, first in the OAS a couple of days ago, and then yesterday at the United Nations, again trying to marshal kind of formal diplomatic support. And then obviously in the back scenes, you have the, you know, the triad of Rubio and Bolton and now Abrams, you know, kind of pushing muscle. The challenge, though, is that in terms of the likely success of this policy, which is, again, to seek the ouster of the Maduro government and to, you know, seek a very rapid kind of legitimization around the Guaido administration, is that it has a very short lifespan. I mean, it has a short shelf life. Every day that passes that Maduro stays in power and that there are fewer and fewer signs of fissures, especially among the military. For instance, just today, there's he's at a military exercises rally in western Venezuela.
Maduro, yeah.
Yeah, Maduro is. Every day that passes that Maduro seems to, you know, have a new lease on life is a day that the stakes are raised significantly for trying to push a forced outcome that moves beyond the diplomatic realm, right? And so for now, I think the major push, and you saw this yesterday with the announcement by the U.S. military or the Venezuelan military attaché in Washington to defect, is to try to create that fissure within the military to force a solution that would push Maduro out of power without that kind of other intervention that we've been talking about.
And again, I'm speaking with Alejandro Velasco, who's a professor at New York University and historian of modern Latin America, focusing on social movements, urban culture, and democratization. He's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. So if we've got a kind of good cop, bad cop situation with Bolton, Elliott Abrahams, and Senator Marco Rubio on one side, and on the other side, Pompeo, nevertheless, there has been talk of from Trump himself of a military option, which is just unbelievably stupid, because if you want to get rid of Maduro, the way to keep him in power is to threaten or even to exercise the military option. But on the other hand, so that's, you know, our foreign policy, of course, is you have to kind of try to figure it out because it's so incoherent. And I imagine that makes life difficult for everybody.
Yeah.
But on the other side, I would think that the Chinese and the Russians, they must have a pretty clear foreign policy objective here, which is to protect their investments. Putin's friend Session has a lot of money invested there, and the Chinese have essentially, you know, mortgaged, or at least the Venezuelans have mortgaged their oil to the Chinese. They've made massive investments against oil deposits. So they've got to be very nervous about a coup engineered by the U.S.
Yeah, no, for sure. The Chinese have, as you say, basically bankrolled. They've been the primary source of financing for Maduro for the last couple of years, as other sources of financing have dried up as a result of U.S. sanctions on credit markets, etc. And so, you know, does Venezuela owe China upwards of $50 billion, but most of that, and in fact, just the other day, one high-ranking government official, Maduro government official, said, yes, we will, you know, deliver as much oil to China as they want. So that is certainly on the table, and they're pushing that that alliance as much as possible. On the other hand, I think the Russia situation is a slightly different scenario, because I don't think they're seeing it so much in terms of specific interests in Venezuela. I think they're seeing it in terms of, you know, larger geopolitical realignment vis-a-vis the United States. So their interest in Venezuela is not specifically around Maduro or oil. Their interest in Venezuela is to keep a kind of beachhead in the region. And so to the extent that, you know, you have these cold warriors, Trump, Pompeo and Bolton and others, seeing Venezuela as an opportunity to be able to reassert a kind of hegemony over the region, which is, again, not to downplay significant, agency in the part of Venezuelans on the ground. But their primary sense, again, in terms of this larger geopolitical picture, is to isolate Russia and to some extent China. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that any government that takes over in Venezuela, especially if it's an opposition government, they would not be in a position to be able to cut off China from the picture. So really the United States is playing at here is to have leverage and certainly the upper hand in an eventual government that would allow for U.S. companies, especially oil companies, to have a greater say in whatever comes next than Chinese interests.
Well, my understanding is that Venezuelan oil, since it's a very heavy crude, there are very few places in the world that can refine it. Most of them refineries are on the Texas Gulf Coast. I think the Cubans refinery, they get discounted oil from Venezuela. They can also process. That's a hugely important part of their economy, because when the Soviets pulled out, they had a real difficult transition until Chavez came along and gave them subsidized oil. So Venezuelans are now saying that they're going to sell a lot of oil to China. Can China, I guess they could build a refinery, right? But at this point, my understanding is that Venezuela is very much dependent upon the U.S. refineries.
Yeah, there's also other refineries in Curaçao, and there's local refineries as well in Venezuela. But the U.S. has signaled that's probably one of its next major targets, right? To either seize outright or to somehow block refining operations, because again, as you just mentioned, that is sort of a major lifeline for Venezuela's potential, or at least the Maduro government's ability to stay in power. On the other hand, the fact is that the Venezuelan oil industry, I mean, what the Maduro government is saying vis-a-vis China and oil is also a bit of a ruse, because the Venezuelan oil industry has been on a tailspin for the last certainly 2 or 3 years. Production levels have dropped to historic lows. Refining capacity has also dropped significantly. And so, for China, I think that the larger issue is not so much the oil that it can get right now, or whether it be refined or otherwise. It's, what is it going to look like in 6 months' time in terms of, renegotiations of contracts that have been conveyed with PDVSA, right? So that's, I think, where the larger play is, not so much, how much actual oil can be sent and dispatched to China, but where is China going to be in a future Venezuelan government?
But the idea of the U.S. putting more pressure on Venezuela via squeezing the oil refineries or refusing to refine the Venezuelan oil or even somehow confiscating Citgo, which is the retail outlet here in the United States for Venezuelan oil. Anything that punishes the Venezuelan people is so counterintuitive. It's cruel and stupid, isn't it? Isn't that the whole point of this rebellion of the Venezuelan people against this incompetent, idiot, wrecking crew of Maduro's? They are the ones that have brought the economy to its knees, an oil-rich country. They're the ones that are creating hyperinflation and long, long lines for food and medicine, etc. So how stupid would it be for the United States to punish the Venezuelan people who are already being punished by Maduro's incompetence?
I mean, it would be stupid, but it wouldn't be the first stupid foreign policy measure that the U.S. has taken, right? So the question here isn't so much for me. I think the way that I see it geopolitically, and as we were talking about before, is that the United States and its allies in Latin America need a quick resolution to this situation. The longer that it lasts, the more power that's going to give to Maduro, not just internally but abroad, to be able to say, well, yes, Guaido might be recognized by some countries, but who actually holds power here? I continue to hold power, right? So the longer that extends, the weaker the position of the opposition actually is, which is why it's not surprising that some of the public messages that Guaido has issued over the last couple of days, he has stressed the point about humanitarian assistance. This is also a point that Mike Pompeo made at the OAS. He said that there's $20 million ready to disperse just as soon as they're able to find a way to get it directly to the Guaido, to Guaido's people. And so, yes, on the one hand, of course, it would be incredibly, paradoxical and counterintuitive to say, well, we're also going to, seize these assets. But I think the symbolic measure would be to say, well, we'll seize these assets and then redirect them towards the Guaido government. And the second that he is formally installed as president, then all those assets will be released, which, the idea would be to generate some pressure at the grassroots to say the problem is Maduro. The money is ready and available. As soon as you get rid of Maduro, then that money is going to start to flow.
Well, we know that there was, I think back in September, there was a meeting between some Venezuelan dissident military officers and the Trump administration, and the Trump people decided not to back a coup attempt. We know that Guaido was recently arrested by the SEBIN, the secret police, who was supposed to be heavily influenced by the Cubans or infiltrated by the Cubans. So two questions. One, is Guaido safe? Who's protecting him? And two, what do you know about fissures in the military, which you just pointed out earlier that now Maduro is with a group of military officers at a military exercise showing the flag and showing that he's in charge? Any cracks there? I guess that's pretty hard to divine, right?
Yeah. I mean, then the first question about Guaido and his level of protection, the fact is that he, you know, and I'm not suggesting anything beyond just what I see on the ground, that he has a kind of golden shield by way of the fact that he, you know, he has been anointed by countries throughout the region and elsewhere as the, you know, legitimate president. And as a result, any, you know, move directly against him by the Maduro government would be seen, I think, as, and in fact, it's been explicitly stated as such by Pompeo and others, would be seen as a direct, you know, assault that would require, you know, stepping up measures, and who knows what those measures might be. So, you know, for now, you know, we've seen that actually, you know, Guaido has appeared in public, he's held rallies, and there haven't been, you know, the kind of moves that, as you suggested, or as you noted, had happened a few weeks ago, where he, you know, was briefly detained and then let go under what actually remained very you know, suspicious kind of conditions. You know, so I think Guaido for now has a kind of golden shield, and the government understands that it really can't touch him. And so what we see is a stalemate that nevertheless, as I talked about before, every day that extends itself is actually favorable for the Maduro government rather than for Guaido and his allies. You know, in terms of the issue of military dissension, yeah, you're right. It's a bit of a black box. One doesn't quite know how, you know, what to make of who may or may not be rebelling. But what seems pretty clear is that the fortunes of most of the upper echelons of the military are pretty well tied to Maduro and his permanence in power. The real question, and this is, I think, is what the National Assembly in passing an amnesty law, or at least trying to, you know, gesture towards a future amnesty, is directing those overtures to, are not the higher echelons of the military. It's the middle ranks, what in Venezuela are called comacate, so commanders, mayors, you know, captains and lieutenants. Those are the ones who command troops on the ground. Those are the ones who would be issued orders to, you know, attack or to repress. Those are the ones who we have already seen, in fact. I mean, there are dozens of jailed military, you know, officers for, you know, a series of conspiracies. So, you know, the fact is that there actually are significant fissures within these middle ranks. The issue is at what stage will they see that, you know, some kind of uprising will be supported abroad and therefore allow them the possibility to be successful in their venture, which would be eventually to, you know, oust Maduro.
Well, Alejandro Velasco, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate your insight.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Alejandro Velasco, who's a professor at New York University and an historian of modern Latin America, focusing on social movements, urban culture, and democratization. And he's the author of Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with the man she loved. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.